Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy using your member number at the snack bar, Charlie Nance.
Hey, welcome back. We're Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. We've got so much to talk about today. Tiger's resurgence and near victory at the Valspar last week. New rules and modifications of rules from the USGA and R&A with Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com. The most thorough and comprehensive examination of increased distance and what blame the golf ball can take for it with Ryan Ballengee of golfnewsnet.com. And we'll check in at Bay Hill, site of the Arnold Palmer Invitational, with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. However, I want to take a second and get on my soapbox about something that's been just chapping my backside for years now, and it reared its ugly head again last week. Every single person who says, why do they show Tiger so much? Why don't they show the other players? They're just as important. Okay, once and for all, lift your head from the kids' table. The adults are talking. Shut up and stop it. In case you've missed the last 20 years, this is the most transcendent athlete the game has ever seen, and it's not close. The ratings for Saturday at the Valspar, were the highest Saturday ratings in golf in 12 years. The Sunday ratings were nearly double what the final round at the U.S. Open or the Open Championship were. And lest you forget, the Open had that amazing finish by Jordan Spieth, and I hasten to point out, both of those are major championships. This was a tournament in March in Tampa. It's the Valspar. So if you're pining away to watch the Brandon Harkins of the world, and nothing against Brandon Harkins, go ahead and sign up for PGA Tour Live and hope that he's in featured groups. However, just know, accept, and realize that you are championing an unnecessarily and stupidly loud minority. If I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times. When you have the opportunity to watch greatness, take it. True greatness in sports is much more rare than you realize, and too soon it's gone, and you'll miss it. Okay, rant over. We begin today with a recipient of the PGA of America's Lifetime Achievement in Journalism from ronsyrak.com. Ron Cyrak. And Ron, I think I want to begin with the title of my show last week. All that is old is new again with Tiger and Phil. How about what's happening?
You know, it's amazing. The one thing that we were denied during the Tiger Woods era, when he was the full Tiger Woods, was a Sunday showdown between Woods and Mickelson in a major championship. You know, that sort of Jack Nicklaus, Tom Watson, duel in the sun at Turnberry, 1977 kind of thing. Wouldn't it be amazing if we got it this year at the age of 42 and 47, that in a time when one of the storylines in golf is all the 20-somethings, to finally see these two 40-something guys go at it and have a classic Sunday shootout? That'd be awesome.
Well, and it would be almost more interesting because their games and their person, they're more fallible at this point. Phil is prone to having some spotty putting, although his putting has been very good this year. Still, he has trouble with fairways. Of course, Tiger's troubles are well documented. So they are not the behemoths that they once were, and it almost would be more interesting now.
You know, I tweeted on Sunday that I've been covering Tiger for 23 years, and the first version of Tiger was larger than life, better than advertised, invincible. There was an inevitability that of course he was going to win. And then on Sunday at the Valspar, you know, we saw him not really struggling, but he didn't have his A game. He wasn't stuffing the iron shots. He was grinding away, makes that awesome 45-foot putt on 17 to keep his hope alive, and ends up finishing second. Well, the old Tiger never would finish second, but I tweeted, I said, you know, this version of Tiger is more human and a little bit easier to love, and the response on that for so far this year, it's my most popular tweet on by more than double, you know, by like 60,000 impressions of that. I think a lot of people related to that this version of Tiger is a little more relatable to all of us. You know, he's not the invincible guy anymore. He's just a guy trying to make it out there.
I'm glad you brought up Sunday because there were two things that caught my attention. And the first one goes along with what you just said. Tiger always got big ovations when he walked to the 18th green because he was the best in the world and, you know, probably sits at a table for two as far as the conversation for greatest of all time. And people, out of respect and just, you know, an honor for seeing what they were seeing, always big ovations for Tiger. Sunday was different in how he reacted to it. It's been a long time since Tiger took a walk up the 18th green with a chance to win a golf tournament. And he seemed to be a little slower in his gait. His hat was off. He was looking at the crowd. He seemed to be really soaking it in. And that's something that we never saw before, and that really struck me.
Yep, I totally agree. This version of Tiger is smiling more. He's engaging more with the galleries. He's looking at them. He's engaging more with his competitors. And if you notice, we didn't hear as many sort of expletive deleteds from Tiger out there. When he hit a bad shot or a shot he wasn't happy with, he was more likely to just sort of laugh. And even when he made that 45-foot putt on 17, he sort of had an embarrassed smile on his face, you know, like, oh, gosh. That went in the old days, he would have just reacted like, well, of course that was going to go in. I do think at the age of 42, Tiger's appreciating it more now than he ever did. There's nothing like having everything and then losing everything and then getting it back to make you appreciate what it was like to have everything. And I think he is right now a little bit softer of a person without losing that competitive intensity.
The other thing that caught my attention on Sunday, and it's something that I've wanted my son, who's a junior golfer, who's old enough. He was around when Tiger was Tiger, but he isn't old enough to really remember it. And the only thing I've ever wanted him to see were the little things that I called the Tiger effect when he was on a golf course. It's why I've always wanted to see a moment where the Jordan Spieths and Ricky Fowlers of the world, and even the Justin Thomases, who grew up with him on the wall, had to face that guy, you know, on the back nine of a big golf tournament. That's what I really wanted to see. But a little small version of the Tiger effect happened on Sunday, and I was able to point it out to him. I said, okay, Patrick Reed is an animal. Give me 10 of him for the Ryder Cup, and I will take it 10 times out of 10. This is a guy who has made big pressure putts on big stages. And he laced a drive on that 18th hole, which is a tough drive for what he did. He hit a driver 310 down the right center of the fairway. About the time he goes to make his second shot, the eruption from the 17th green and Tiger rolling in that bomb takes place. And what happens at that point? Patrick Reed hits a shot that was just a little short and rolls down the hill. He hits a putt that doesn't make it up the hill. And all of a sudden, Patrick Reed goes from being in a tie for the lead to all of a sudden finishing second. And to me, that was always part of the Tiger effect, was what happened to everyone else on the golf course when the unmistakable roar went up and they knew something had happened.
Yeah, it's not just the intimidation factor, it's the distraction factor. If you look at it in this run that the Tiger's been on coming back, the guys who played with him, with the exception of Sam Burns, the guys who played with him have not played well because of all the whole circus that's going on around Tiger. And so it's not just Tiger intimidating you with his game, it's Tiger intimidating you with the fact that, on Sunday, the final group, Tiger's in the next to the last group, the final group had virtually nobody following it because everybody was in the group ahead with Tiger. All that gets into the heads of the people that he's playing against.
One last thing about Tiger before we move on to something else. One of my favorite things to overhear when I'm at the golf course on the weekends is I just hear it all the time, the gripe, I'm tired of seeing Tiger. Nobody wants to see Tiger. Why don't they show all these other golfers? And then I just show them the TV numbers. I said, this is why. The Sunday rating for the Valspar. The Valspar was, you know what, 1.5 shares or almost 2 shares higher than the final round of the U.S. Open and the Open Championship. You don't think that makes a big difference?
Yeah, 5.11 rating. That's a major. That's a U.S. Open kind of rating for a Sunday. That's not a not the Valspar kind of rating that you get. And I had the same reaction as you. Following at the end, I was on Twitter tweeting about it, and there would be those people out there saying, "Who cares? Talk about who's leading." You know, and you just want to say, if you can't buy into this, then you're not a golf fan, because this is fascinating. And to me, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if Tiger's going to win again. I think he will. I don't know if Tiger's going to win a major again. He probably will. I don't think he's going to get five majors to pass Nicklaus's record. But the fact is, we don't know. But what we are seeing is one of the greatest athletes ever to play any sport playing well right now. And what's not right with that? But there's always been a group of people out there from the very beginning. There's been a significant group of Tiger haters, who thought he was too flamboyant, who just didn't like him, and we're always going to root against him. And the Mickelson-Woods rivalry is sort of like the when I was a kid, the Willie Mays-Mickey Mantle argument, which is you were either for one or the other, but you couldn't be for both. You had to say one was the best of all time. And you're either a Mickelson fan, and believe me, golf's in a really good place right now because the three people who move the needle more than anybody else in golf are Phil Mickelson, Tiger Woods, and Michelle Wee. And they all, two of them won tournaments, and the third one almost won a tournament in a period of a week. That's good for the game.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. Ron Cyrak of ronsyrak.com is our guest taking Dead Aim. I wanted to ask you quickly about the LPGA, and I, too, this year have become a buyer. The American players are really, really starting to play well. You mentioned that Michelle Wee won. Lexi Thompson is playing solid. Both of the quarter girls are playing really, really well. And someone who I'm rooting for, who I find eminently rootable, and she's been gone for 6 or 7 months recovering from surgery, quietly Paula Creamer is making her return this week. How good would it be for the game for Paula Creamer to all of a sudden be healthy and making an impact again?
Yeah, Paula Creamer is really, she bleeds red, white, and blue. She is all about American golf. And I covered the first tournament she ever won on the LPGA. She was 18 years old. She won the Sybase tournament at Waikiki in New York. And then later that year, she won her second tournament, the Evian Championship in France. And, I was there that night, and I remember remember Julie Inkster took her out partying after she won then. But, she won when she was 18 years old. But who would have guessed when she won the 2010 U.S. Women's Open at Oakmont with a six-hole finish, the final six-hole her finish there was unbelievably good, played at 2 under par on what's, in my mind, the hardest golf course on the planet. Who would have guessed that 8 years later she'd have only have one victory since then? It's what happened to Paula's. I've seen it happen to other players. I saw it happen to Tom Watson, to Nick Faldo, to Johnny Miller, which is the putter went. And when the putter went, it starts putting pressure on the rest of your game. You feel this need to hit the ball closer and closer to the hole, and that makes the rest of your game unravel. And that's sort of what happened to Paula. And she's now changed everything. She's changed coach. She's changed caddies. And she had been sort of following the Annika Sorenstam model, which is put together a team you trust and stick with it. She had the same coach, same caddy for pretty much her entire career. But she's making a lot of changes now, and it would be terrific for the game if she came back and started to compete again. And she's still young. She's in her early 30s.
You mentioned Michelle Wee. She won in spectacular fashion 2 weeks ago, and I was just thinking to myself, it would be great if we could have just one year where Weezy wasn't getting hurt. And I was thinking, maybe this is the year. And then lo and behold, I looked last week, and there was talk of, well, she just got another shot, and she's pain-free. So, I mean, it's an ongoing cycle with her. You brought up Mickey Mantle. Without the awards and the great seasons, she's kind of Mickey Mantle in that she is just snake bit with injuries.
Yeah, it's been injury and illness throughout her career. She's had bursitis, she's had Achilles problems, she's had shoulder problems, back problems, and she has a zillion food allergies and all these other things going on, she has not been able to get through a healthy season. And I also think that she was hurt by some of the decisions that her team made early in her career. I think she'd have been better served if she had played when she was 14 years old, if she had worried about beating 14-year-old girls rather than trying to make a cut against male pros. I think she would have learned more and would have developed more of a competitive toughness and more of a learning how to win. And I think she's still playing catch-up on all that. I do think, and I said it on Golf Channel in January this year, I said rattling around inside of her is that kind of five-win, two-major season that we've been expecting from her. And, you know, she's got five wins, one major for her entire career. I think she's capable of going out if she could stay healthy and have that kind of season. She also seems, like Tiger, to be going back to wanting to play the way she played when she was a kid, which is to just enjoy the game more and be more of a feel player and less of a technical player.
Well, I remember several years ago, one of the most fun major championships in golf period that I saw was Lexi Thompson and Michelle Wee dueling it out for a couple of days, and especially when they were paired together on that Sunday. Two completely different strategies to play in a golf course at the A&A Inspiration. And, you know, golf can do nothing. The ladies' game can do nothing but get healthy and better in a hurry if you have those two competing down the stretch.
Yeah, you know, Michelle probably moves the needle more than anybody in the women's game since Nancy Lopez. And the one thing that her camp did entirely right is they built up name recognition. Everybody knows who Michelle is. And Michelle, again, to make the Tiger comparison, she stands out. She's 6'1". She hits the ball a long ways. She's Asian American. You know, just everything about her makes her stand out as something different than the other players out there. And you know, I always said about Tiger, right down to his name, Tiger Woods, an advertising exec couldn't have dreamed him up any better. And it's sort of the same for Michelle. You could not dream up a more marketable person than her. And she's funny. She's smart. You know, she's really an engaging person. And we're learning more of that about her now, too. I think that that's coming out in a way, you know, she carried that burden of expectation on her shoulders for so long, where it was put on her at such an early age that she was going to be the first woman to play in the Masters, and now she doesn't have that on her anymore. I remember her; she told me about 3-4 years ago. She said her proudest accomplishment is having a degree from Stanford University, and I thought, wow, that's amazing. This is somebody who's starting to put her life into a very healthy perspective.
Ron Cyrak, ronsyrak.com is our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here asking you about the other huge story that came out this week, and that is the RNA and the USGA simplifying the rules of golf from 34 to 24. We will get the final book, I guess, starting in September. They go into effect in 2019, but there were a lot of really interesting and, in my opinion, really good alterations and modifications to the rules of golf, especially when it comes to the amateur game in terms of how to deal with out of bounds, loose impediments and bunkers and, you know, accidentally brushing the sand in bunkers, things that have just been stupid for way too long. But I bring up the out of bounds ruling for amateurs because for the first time, it appears, I'm going to use the word, it appears that the ruling bodies are not running away from bifurcation.
And I think that the interesting connection that people aren't really making as solidly as they should make right now is that you're absolutely right. The out-of-bounds rule is a massive step towards bifurcation. And look, bifurcations existed unofficially forever. You know, mulligans and gimmies and all that sort of stuff. You know, that's not in the rules of golf. That's all bifurcation. But this officializing a form of bifurcation comes up right as distance is once again on the radar screen, and people are talking about it again. They're talking about how far, you know, I was checking out the Tiger's stats the other day, and I saw he's averaging 303.2 yards off the tee. I thought, wow, that's pretty good. It's number 42 in driving distance. I remember when John Daly was the only player on the PGA Tour who averaged over 300 yards in driving distance. And I think we talked about this once before. It's really only going to become an issue for the pro game when it starts to affect the entertainment value of the game.
Yes.
If it becomes purely a drive and a wedge game, then it's an issue. If Augusta National and Pebble Beach and the old course of St. Andrews become obsolete because they're too short, then it becomes an issue. It's not that issue yet. But they have opened the door to bifurcation with these rules changes.
He's one of the best. From RonCyrak.com, the great Ron Cyrak. And when we return, GolfNewsNet.com has published what I feel is the most comprehensive and fair assessment of the modern golf ball and what to do about it. The author, Ryan Ballingy, takes dead aim at the magic dimpled sphere, presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ryan Ballingy has written an amazing piece thoroughly examining the golf ball and what to do about it online at golfnewsnet.com. We had the chance to catch up earlier this week. Ryan, before we dive into the stats and the numbers, I want to clarify your position, as is mine at the moment. You are pro-bifurcation and rolling back the ball for the pros. But I also think you and I agree that no ball manufacturer, and by no I mean zero ball manufacturers, are going to be on board with making a ball that can't be marketed to Joe Blow golfer, because none of us want a ball that's going to go less. And it's for that reason and that reason alone that I don't see this happening, as companies and ruling bodies are going to have to be in sync on this, right?
It seems that way. I mean, there's only really been one company that's come out so far and said, we're okay with bifurcation, and that's Bridgestone Golf. And they said that their CEO said in November with an interview with golf.com that they feel there should be a rollback, that the ball goes too far for professionals. But other than that, we've heard from Titleist parent company, Acushnet, which they've been staunchly against the idea of a rollback for as long as I've been having this argument with people, 13, 14 years. And it makes reasonable sense. They sell the most golf balls. They pay the most people to use their golf balls on tour. So if you make a golf ball that's different that the amateur would play versus a recreational golfer would play, as opposed to a high-level competitive amateur or a professional golfer, that could erode their market share because you're essentially hitting the reset button on the golf ball market. So I can completely understand why OEMs, original equipment manufacturers, would be against this idea of bifurcation, because you're essentially asking them to make two sets of equipment, one that they already make, then they have to reverse engineer the existing equipment with all the materials and performance stuff that they do today, but make it go less in terms of, and don't perform as well. And then you have to ask them, well, are you still willing to pay professionals to wear your logo and tout that they play your equipment when you can't market that same equipment to recreational players? Because, as you just mentioned, they don't want to play the equipment that will go less. They want to play the stuff that's going to go as long as humanly possible.
Well, and the other thing that keeps that would keep me from really being on board with this, and it's funny how this argument sort of gains steam when you're playing these golf courses like out in Palm Desert and out in Hawaii, where the ball will roll forever and people start to get all up in arms. And then when everybody starts to really dive into it, all of a sudden the tour goes to, you know, Riviera and the Honda and the Valspar. What 10 under won the Valspar this last weekend? You mean to tell me that the best golfers in the world over four rounds of golf, you know, could only get it to 10 under par? And there's something to be said for the way a golf course is set up and the way the greens are, that I think they could control a lot of this too.
And there has been some of that over the years. This is probably a 10-year-old thing now, but around 2006, the PGA Tour kind of subtly experimented with some really impossible pin positions from week to week. And I can distinctly remember Peter Costas talking about this, and Torrey Pines talking about, this pin is only 3 yards from the edge. It's only 2 paces from the edge. This is ridiculous. I remember him saying that on air. And you would notice it and go, that's impossible. And that's basically what the tour thought they had to do to kind of rein in scoring, rein in golf ball distance, and make it so challenging with a second shot, make it so challenging to get to the pin, that you wanted to put a premium on hitting the fairway. That was kind of the idea behind the USGA's regulation of wedge grooves in the early 2000s, you know, the mid-2000s, that they wanted to backdoor a way to regulate golf ball distance by convincing professionals and competitive amateurs that if you hit the ball in the rough, even if it went a long way, you would lose so much spin and performance that would make more sense for you to scale back a little bit and hit the fairway. Well, the equipment manufacturers figured out a way around that in about 30 seconds before they even had the regulation introduced for players to use it, so for the professionals to use it. So they had already skirted the rule. I mean, there are ways to rein in scoring, and there are ways to promote scoring, and that's really more setup than anything. I mean, the LPGA has taken a very loose approach to setup in the last couple of years. Last year, the winning score in the LPGA was 20 under par every week.
Yeah,
every week. They just made birdies and eagles accessible because they came out with the idea, okay, people want to see birdies and eagles. They don't want to see pros struggling for pars. So we're going to give them birdies and eagles. And ratings were up. People liked that. And part of that is just the natural progression of the tour. But, yeah, they made it pretty friendly for the players. They could go the complete opposite other way. They could make the rough really deep, the narrow fairways, green super rock hard and fast, and make it extremely difficult. And I think that they realize, as just as the PGA Tour, the European Tour, and everybody else does, that's not entertaining golf. This is an entertainment piece of things at the end of the day. And so you've got to kind of find a way to reach a reasonable middle, I think, with setup. Not too easy, not too difficult. The tour struggle with that at times. But I think for someone like me who's pro bifurcation, you have to separate setup from architecture. And the argument from people who want to roll back, generally speaking, is we want to preserve architecture. We want to preserve the way courses were designed so that when players compete on the courses built in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s today, they still have to play basically the same style of golf with slight improvements of technology over time. And that's kind of the conflation, the argument that's kind of difficult to separate from people. And that's kind of in part why I've been talking about this for so long is, it seems like everyone is having a different argument about what the problem is and then what to do about it. So it splinters off in 100 different directions, and you can't have the same conversation with someone the same day. And until we get all on the same page about what we perceive the problem is, evaluate if there is one, and perceive the potential set of options to do something about it, then we're just going to keep talking in circles.
Ryan Ballingy with thegolfnewsnet.com is our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, let's jump into this. One of the first points you make in the piece that you wrote that I think is exceptional is it's real easy to blame the ball, but to just blame the ball doesn't tell part of the story. And you go back further than most people do to when we had great innovations with the drivers, the big heads, the titanium. And I think that's important, too, because everyone's complaint isn't about the distance these guys are getting off their irons. In fact, most pros will come out and tell you that they're hitting their irons marginal, if not the same length that they did when they were in college and amateur. So that's not a problem. It's the length off the driver.
Yeah, and I think that's also part of the misunderstanding of the argument, too. Because if you look back over the last, let's go back to the solid core ball. Let's go to the birth of the Pro V1, 2001, 2002. In that stretch of time, we really only have evidence, because this is the only thing we track in professional golf, of how far drivers go, how far tee shots go. And generally speaking, it's about 25 to 26 yards on the PGA Tour over the last 16 years. And so you think, all right, well, is the driver the problem? Is the golf ball the problem? Well, you get the golf ball in every shot. So if you gain 26 yards with the driver over time, then do you also gain 26 yards with your 3-wood, with your 5-iron, with your 9-iron? And it's a spectrum. You know, Ryan,
you can't say that the effect, the trampoline effect off a driver is comparative to the effect off of an iron. That makes no sense.
I completely agree with you. I'm going to lay out this argument in a second. So the spectrum is different, right? I mean, a 9-iron goes farther today for professional golfers than it did 15 years ago, but not to the same extent that it does off of a driver. Maybe it's 6 yards or 7 yards. But 27 yards. Guys that used to hit 140-yard 9-iron are now not hitting it 167 yards. That's preposterous.
Right.
But then you kind of have this hyperbolic curve effect where, you know, the short irons don't go all that much farther. Mid-irons do go substantially farther, maybe, let's say, 12 yards. And then you kind of look at long irons, and then especially into hybrids and fairway woods, and we've seen tremendous distance gains in terms of fairway woods in really the last 5 years, because the performance has just been there with better materials. And so you're trying to distill, all right, well, where are all the distance gains coming from? How do they affect an entire performance of a golf course? And then can you say with certainty it's the golf ball's fault. And throughout the course of this piece, you know, I came into it writing about, okay, well, we've seen this distance increase off the driver. You have to think about it in each and every shot. So that's why they've added length to all these championship golf courses. But can you say with certainty that it's the golf ball's fault? And really, you can't. The evidence is just not there to support throwing it all on the golf ball. There are a lot of different reasons why the golf ball goes longer with each and every shot, and just blaming it on one piece of equipment is a disservice to the argument.
One thing that I didn't see in your article, and I would just like to get your thoughts on it, an underrated piece of technological advance over the last 18 years, and all you have to do is look at the price of them if you really dig deep. We've come a long way in terms of shafts, what the golf shaft will do as well. What are your thoughts on that?
I think every it's clear that every component of a golf club is better than it used to be. It's remarkably better. It's lighter. It has a better kick point. It is better engineered. You name it, it does better than it used to. So you can't just say, all right, well, the golf ball's better. Yes, the golf ball's better. But so are the heads. So are the shafts. Grips are better. Lasts longer. Performance is all around better. So then you add on to the component that not a lot of people talk about, or they kind of allude to, but they can't stick numbers to, really, until we did this piece of, well, guys just hit better now. They have a better golf swing because of TrackMan, because of launch monitor technology. The guys are glued to it. They hone in their swings based on it, and they hit the ball better because of that. Well, turns out that's true. They probably gained about 7 to 8 yards per player based on just swing efficiency, because they know what smash factor is now. They know how to get the most out of their swing speed with ball speed. So you look at equipment, you look at teaching, a little bit fitness. I mean, honestly, swing speed has not increased dramatically, maybe 1.8 miles per hour, depending on the player over the years in terms of average.
So do you think the everybody talking about fitness, do you think that's somewhat overrated?
I don't think it's necessarily overrated. I just don't think there's necessarily a correlation in swing speed. But maybe that correlates to better swing efficiency. Maybe that's where it comes in, and we just haven't figured out that direct connection yet. So I'm reluctant to say being more fit does not lead to a better golf performance, but it doesn't seem to lead at least directly to higher swing speed, because that really has not changed in 15 years.
Ryan Ballingy, thegolfnews.net or thegolfnewsnet.com is our guest taking Dead Aim. You alluded to TrackMan, and I've seen many players allude to the fact that this is part of the problem. I find it ironic because it seems to be the tool that everyone wants to go to hone their swing, yet it's part of the problem. Is this piece of equipment the ultimate engineering catch 22?
I'm reluctant to say that. I mean, there's only so well the golf ball and the golf shot and the golf stroke can perform. It's kind of the nature of things. We've only been able to get to about a smash factor of 1.52, and that's the absolute maximum limit. And we haven't really seen anything beyond that. So unless the USGA and RNA loosen equipment standards, I don't think we're going to see anything beyond that in the near future. So having a better idea of how the swing works, what actually happens when you hit the golf ball, what it really does when it flies, I think that's beneficial for the sport. I think it's better for the amateur golfer, just it really hasn't distilled its way all the way down to an amateur golfer, to the recreational golfer, because so many pros, I mean, who's going to spend $25,000 on a TrackMan?
Right.
There just aren't that many people out there, other than professional golfers who are looking for the smallest edge possible to win $1 million every week, that are going to invest that kind of money to be able to understand golf swings better. So the technology is tremendous. I mean, I don't see a problem with having launch monitor technology whatsoever. The problem is just about everything we've talked about here. The amateur, the recreational golfer, never really sees the total benefits of the technology, of TrackMan, of better performance, of better swing efficiency, because they're just not that good. This technology is designed to be maximized by players who beat balls all day, who consistently make great contact, and amateur golfers don't do that. They hit maybe one good drive around, a couple pure shots around. They have, by most accounts, I mean, I play with a bunch of my in-laws and good friends over the weekend in Orlando. they stood over the ball, and 95% of the time had zero idea not only where the ball was going, but how far it was going. So if you tell me, you know, if you tell an amateur the ball goes too far, they're going to go, what are you talking about? I've never hit the ball too far in my entire life, because they're not good enough to. And that's part of the conversation we're not having, is just a realistic understanding that amateur golfers are not good, and that's okay. That's why they're amateurs. Professionals, that's their livelihood. They've been able to max out the technology because they need an edge. Whatever their edge is, they need to be able to do that. And it's just a different set of requirements.
All right, so if we break it down, and we're talking about the top 10 players of the world basically picking up 27 yards over the last 16, 18 years, and you break that down, you know, 6.5 goes to the ball, 6.5 to the equipment, 6.5 to you know, swings and better coaching, 6.5 to smash factor. That all is that sort of what you're thinking, that all these things are equally to blame, or, and maybe that's not the term, but equally contributing to all of this?
I wouldn't say it's equal. I think that the golf ball is still a pretty good chunk of that 26 yards we talked about. I would say it's about a little bit more than half, because if you look at the moment in time when we went from wound golf balls to solid core golf balls, basically within the space of 2 years, driving average went up 17 yards. But so basically we're looking at like 12, 12, and 5, 12, 12, and 6. So if you think about it that way, all right, well, if you're a part of the bifurcation or rollback crowd like me, and we roll back the golf ball, then how much do you roll it back? Do you roll it back 30 yards? Do you roll it back that far?
Well, the number Nicholas always throws out is 20%, which I always sounded like a big number to me.
It's hogwash. I mean, I do not want to hit the ball 60 yards less.
No!
And I can launch the golf ball. I do not want to hit the golf ball 60 yards less. You are going to pry that golf ball from my cold, dead hand. So I think that's a little too far. But if you look at, all right, let's take the golf ball out of the equation. Let's say the golf ball is the problem. We're going to roll back the golf ball. Well, that's a 5% rollback on a 300-yard drive. That doesn't sound as terrible. That's 15 yards. That's one club, one extra club in every hole.
Get you out of here on this. Ryan Ballingy is with thegolfnewsnet.com. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I really would have thought that bifurcation is just something the media and you and I can talk about. Up until this week with the release of the new modified rules of golf, and for the first time in my lifetime, it appears that the governing bodies are not running away from two different sets of rules, especially the out-of-bounds local rule, which will be in effect for amateur golf, but not for the professionals, and they lined that out. With that being said, is that something that you think as well, that we actually could be on the verge of bifurcation?
I honestly think we'll never get bifurcation, because the USGA and the RNA stuck a quote in their distance report from 2017 that's kind of got this whole thing stirred up again. That came from 2002. They released what's called a joint statement of principles. And at that time, they wanted to address solid core golf ball, the distance hikes we had seen just so quickly. And they said back then, and they still maintain this today, they want golf to be played under one set of rules for professionals, amateurs, and high-level competitors. No matter who you are, play under the same set of rules and equipment standards. And they maintain that in this distance report.
The piece is entitled Retrying the Case for Rolling Back the Golf Ball from Scratch. I commend it to everyone. That was its author, Ryan Ballingy. Taking Dead Aim is presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is down in Orlando at Bay Hill Club and Lodge for the Arnold Palmer Invitational. Ron, if I'd have told you on January 1st that by the time we got to Bay Hill, Tiger Woods would be an 8-1 favorite to win the Masters, what would you have said?
You're dreaming, or, you know, I would like to come up with some way to con you into investing in something that wasn't real or something, but that has all changed. I mean, it's like there's like this euphoric wave that has come over golf and golf fans all of a sudden with, you know, Tiger everywhere he's been and what he's done, Valspar and Bay Hill now, and, I mean, with the Masters right there. I mean, it's in some ways it sort of feels like it used to, but in other ways it feels like, is this really happening?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because you have the unique perspective of having covered Tiger from the start to now. How is it different now than it was at the height of his power?
Well, I think at the height of his power, we knew what he was going to do, and we had the expectation of what he was going to do, and it felt like more often than not, he delivered on that expectation. Now this is all, I mean, it sort of has begun as a curiosity and almost a sort of a, I don't know, a doubting curiosity that was turned to like, hey, he's a little better than I thought, to now, oh my gosh, he's going to win the Masters type thing. I think it's like almost like having a second Christmas. Like you thought you'd gotten everything, and all of a sudden, wait a minute, here we got more stuff now, because I think most of us had sort of expected we'd seen the end of Tiger, or at least the end of the really good, dominant Tiger, and he's showing those signs now of that being true. I mean, it's been a revelation. I think he's a little surprised, and I know at Bay Hill, he was talking about just look at how the tenor and subject of the questions to him have changed just over the last 6 or 8 weeks. It's just been dramatic, and I mean, it's a remarkable story.
Ron, I got to thinking about something last week as I was looking at the crowds at the Valspar, and then again this morning. I mean, he teed off early. As we record this, Tiger completed his first round, but his crowds this morning were phenomenally deep, even by Tiger Woods standards. And I was thinking back to when, and maybe this is a poor analogy, but maybe it's not. You know, the Eagles broke up in 1980 or 1981 and didn't reappear until the mid-90s. And ever since then, they had been, you know, it was a curiosity. Oh, my God, I never got to see them. I got to make sure I go see the Eagles. And I feel like there's not a full generation of fans, but a good portion of fans who, in the last 4 or 5 years, they never saw the great Tiger Woods. And so this is their chance to go see it, and so everyone's taking this opportunity. Is that a good analogy?
I think that's, yeah, I think there's something to that. I think there's a big portion of the fans who want to go back and see it again and hope it's happening again, or some variation of it's happening again. And then there's some people who've never really got to see it, and it's just like, hey, Tiger's back, and look, he's playing well. And you know, I think sort of the third layer of it or whatever is, so many of these young players, whether it's Fowler or Justin Thomas or Jordan Spieth or whomever, they heard about it, they watched it from afar, saw it on TV growing up. But now it's their world. He's in their world. And, you know, he's not just the assistant captain for the Ryder Cup or President's Cup team. He's Tiger. And, you know, whether I think it's more coincidental, but you wonder when you see Jordan Spieth struggling last week at Valspar, playing two rounds with Tiger and missing the cut, and Henrik Stenson too, and Tiger's the one emerging from that threesome into the weekend. You know, you wonder, I think guys who haven't played with Tiger in those circumstances, you know, with those kind of galleries, I got to believe there's a bit of a learning curve, because, yeah, you can be out there on Saturday and Sunday afternoon in contention, and it's one thing, but when you throw Tiger into the mix, it's a little something different.
Thank you for bringing that up. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is our guest taking Dead Aim. I was talking with Ron Cyrak earlier, and I was discussing the Tiger effect and things that these players have never experienced and couldn't have anticipated, and just pointing up an example that I saw last week to my son. You know, Tiger rolls in that bomb on 17 about the time that Patrick Reed is about to take his second shot out of the middle of the fairway after bombing it on 18, and he is tied for the lead. He proceeds to come up maybe a quarter to a half club short, gets up to the green, doesn't make the putt to the top of the hill, it rolls back down. Consequently, he winds up taking bogey. And who knows if that was the Tiger effect or not, but that roar that went up had to make somebody think, because they've never heard that before.
Yeah, I think it's a different kind of roar because, as you mentioned earlier, the size of the galleries is so big, and you know it's going to be louder. And then you throw in it's Sunday afternoon and 17, and he's making whatever a 40 or 50 footer, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, he's going to the last hole with a chance for this thing. I mean, those are different kind of roars. I think if you go to enough Masters, you come to sort of recognize what the sounds of the galleries are, from where they come and when they come. And I think there's a Tiger galleries at every event. And when he's doing things like that, sort of like
oh, okay, we know what happened there. That's Tiger.
Ron, has there been any question, any medical questions to either Tiger or to a doctor? It seems to me that what he is doing is physically impossible. This is nothing short of a medical miracle. What we're seeing, someone who has had their back cut on now four times and is able to generate greater club head speed than he did before the first surgery. This is strange, is it not? It's beyond strange.
Well, I think it's certainly unexpected. Tiger's asked whatever day Tuesday down at Bay Hill, how do you explain the club head speeds you have after being away and going through what you've gone? And Tiger just sort of raised his hands up and said, dude, if I knew, I'd tell you, but I don't have any idea. You know, I think he said he thinks that the gradual deterioration of his back and all that came with it just led him to lose speed gradually and more than he realized maybe. And you know, it's the old thing, you didn't know how bad you felt till you felt good again. And now it's back. It's like, wow, it really had a big impact.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is our guest taking Dead Aim. I'm wondering, we're now really only a couple of weeks into it after the Honda and then the Valspar. I'm wondering how long it's going to take before the novelty of these players talking about Tiger Woods becomes what they dealt with for more than a decade, what I called Tiger fatigue, of no matter how they played, no matter what happened in their round, they were asked questions about Tiger. Has that started to happen yet?
I don't think it's starting to happen. I think there is, it's as fresh to them as to anybody. I think they're interested. And, you know, I mean, Paul Casey's sitting there last week in Tampa saying, you know, if I don't win, I hope Tiger does. I mean, I think they recognize who he is and what he has done and what he's trying now to do. And, yeah, there will be a point where it's like, hey, what about me or what, you know, other things. But I think at least till we get through the Masters, it's Tiger.
Ron, something else that happened this week, and I thought the timing may have been ill-timed, maybe it wasn't, was the PGA of America's announcement of the next President Cup's captains. Not surprised that Ernie Els got it. A little surprised that not only was Tiger named, but he sort of stepped up and asked to be the President's Cup captain, when I'm getting the impression that he's fully committed to trying to be a player on upcoming team events. Did it surprise you? Did it surprise others?
Well, I think there was a sense he was going to be a President's Cup / Ryder Cup captain at some point down the line. Yeah, maybe a little sooner than we thought. I think the genesis of it goes back to late last year, before Tiger knew he was going to be able to come and do this. I think he always had that option open and hoped it would come to what it looks like it will come to, will he play or not? But I think maybe had he known then what he knows now about his back and everything, maybe he would have pushed it back a little bit. I don't know. I'm just speculating. But I think he's going to be a really good one. I think he really wants to do it. And I think, you know, at this point, I would think he, very real possibility, he would be a playing captain. He wouldn't be the first. Dale Irwin was a playing captain in the President's Cup before, so we'll just wait and see. I mean, it was perfect natural timing for Ernie Els, who, you know, I mean, with the President's Cup coming to Charlotte in 2021, I would expect that Ernie would probably do it more than one time, so maybe he will be the international captain in Charlotte. But, yeah, I mean, maybe a little quick for Tiger, but he's fired up about it.
One more question about Tiger, and really it has to do with Tiger's generation. How great is it having the possibility of, at this point in their careers, Phil hitting on all cylinders winning, Tiger on the verge of winning, and so you also have this cross-section of these young stars, the Dustin Johnsons, Jordan Spieths, Ricky Fowlers, you know, Justin Thomases. We could have an unbelievable mixture of greatness in the mix at the Masters.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, you're exactly right. When you, for once, at least at this point, it looks like we're going to bring everything in at the same time, sort of, because we've always had somebody hurt or this is going on or whatever, and maybe there's a sense of incompleteness to it. I mean, Tiger hadn't played there very often in the last 5 years, so
And, you know, it's one thing if he was just going to go back there and try. Now we've seen what he's capable of doing, and we saw Phil win at Mexico City and all that. It's a very good – I mean, if you were trying to, you know, put it all together, it would be hard to make it better leading in than it is right now.
Get you out of here on this. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is our guest taking Dead Aim. This is now year two of the Arnold Palmer Invitational without – Arnold Palmer being there. Last year they had the big statue unveiling. It was a big emotional time. What is it like at Bay Hill this week?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot of effort is being made to keep Arnie and his spirit and who he was alive in this tournament. And, you know, I think it's nice that they're working that way. I don't know that they have to work that hard. I think people come to Bay Hill and know what it is and who it was and what it's all about. And, you know, they've got a good feel. The golf course is really good condition. But, you know, I mean, you got Curtis Strange and Annika Swornstam and Graham McDowell and other Sam Saunders sort of taking the front role. But they're all there as sort of ambassadors and working to keep this going and build on it and not let it slip back into something maybe it didn't used to be. And, yeah, I mean, it's, you don't have to go far. I mean, if you wanted to walk in and get you one of those white and green and red and yellow umbrellas down there, I mean, they got those for sale, and there's the big Arnold statue out there, and it's just, you know, it's still a celebration of him. They have the little opening ceremony there on Wednesday. I think that tournament feels like it's in a good place this year.
From Bay Hill, that's Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. I'd also like to thank Ryan Ballingy of GolfNewsNet.com and the great Ron Syrak from RonSyrak.com for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast on Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Weather-wise, well, you may have to dodge some droplets here and there, but for the most part, it looks like a good weekend to tee it up and take on this game that breaks our heart and haunts our soul. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors.